Morning.
Morning.
Thanks for coming. As we move along in our study, one of the principal topics and possibly the only topic that we will get to this week, given how much material we have to cover, is one of the issues where Jesus is debating with his Sadducee opponents who did not believe in the resurrection of the dead. I think we've said that in the past, there were a number of different factions within Judaism at the time who had different views regarding the issue of life after death. Sadducees, who were responsible for management of the temple, that really was their principal, actually their only job, was management of the temple, where sacrifices were done, only accepted the first five books of Moses, the Torah, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. And if you read through those books, there isn't any specific reference to the resurrection or life after death. And so if that's where you're limited to, you don't have references to resurrection or any kind of life beyond the grave. If you're a Pharisee, the Pharisees accepted more than that as being a divinely inspired revelation, including the prophets and the Psalms. And of course, Jesus quotes the prophets and the Psalms throughout his ministry, and certainly would not be falling into the realm of the beliefs of the Sadducees. So here, we want to take a look at what the Sadducees say to him and what his response is. The question that they're going to pose to him in an attempt to trip him up is to examine the practical implications of and difficulties of a resurrection life after death. And what they do is they begin with, what about a person who had several marriages? So you take a look here, and they ask him, Moses wrote us, if a man's brother died and leaves a wife behind him and they have no children, his brother should take his wife and raise up seed to his brother. Okay, that is a commandment of the Torah, that you should do that. If that takes place, you should proceed with that. And then they go on to say that many men had her as a wife because of their passing, and the question becomes, who will have her in the resurrection as a wife? Did I lose my power here?
Yes.
I lost my power. Better?
Yes.
Thank you. So that's an interesting question. Whose wife will she be in the resurrection if several men have her as wife? Jesus says, answer. Can you move that again? Not touching. Technology. Jesus' answer is, when people go to the next world, we lost it again.
I
guess.
Not. Don't worry, I can hear you.
You can hear me okay?
Can
hear me okay. Sorry. There's no marriage relationships in heaven. You may recognize people, but there are no marriage relationships in the kingdom. People that are like the angels. So there's no sexuality or marriage. That's how he answers their question. So the question then comes, what about resurrection in Hebrew scripture? You don't find any of it at all in the first five books, but where do you find it? It's an interesting thing here. This is the most explicit statement in the Hebrew scriptures about life after death. You comb all of it, you find nothing more explicit than this. And you will find also that Jesus will almost quote this verbatim in John's gospel account, and I have that slide coming for you as well. This is from Daniel chapter 12. And again, within Christianity, Daniel is accepted as a major prophet. Why is he a major prophet? Because it's quoted often, and paramount within New Testament quotation of Hebrew scriptures. In the Hebrew scriptures, according to Jewish understanding, Daniel doesn't even qualify as a prophet. He's parked at the back of the book with Psalms and Ecclesiastes, not considered an important prophet at all. So let's take a look here why this is such a critical thing in Christian doctrine. Michael, the great prince that stands for the children of the people, shall be a time of trouble as never was since there was a nation. In that time, people shall be delivered, everyone that shall be found written in the book. Interesting thing, written in the book. In Judaism, each year people pray that they would be written in the book for another year. May God give me another year's life, and I would be written in the book of life for another year. That is not this book. This is quoted in Revelation as being the Lamb's book of life, the book of eternal life, not another year. Everybody gets delivered whose name is found written in the book. And here I've bolded this. Many of them that sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, some to shame and everlasting contempt. Interesting text there. Many of them. Well, does many mean everybody? Many to me doesn't mean everybody. But some people say many here means everybody. So what happens to the people who don't get it? Excuse me, sir. I need the next slide here. Okay. And some get shame and everlasting contempt. What does that mean? That doesn't say anything about being tortured in a fire. That can have lots of different meanings. And here's how Jesus quotes this. And this will be a controversial issue within Christianity regarding what happens to a person when they die. The Father has life in himself, so he has given it, life to the Son. He's given authority to execute judgment because he's the Son of Man. Marvel not at this, the hour is coming in which all that are in their graves will hear his voice. But Jesus moves it from many to all, and shall come forth. They have done good to the resurrection of life, and they who have done evil to the resurrection of damnation. Now we can read quickly through that, but there is a lot of controversy here. Let me explore that controversy for a moment. And of course, we go into this segment because it's an issue raised by the Sadducees, saying there's no resurrection of the dead, and Jesus says there is, but it's not. The relationships are not the way you understand them. Here, the Father gives Jesus authority. There are many early understandings of Christianity that Jesus is not the same as God the Father, part of the Trinity. But he is a subordinate being and had to be given authority. He is a God, but he's not God in the same way God the Father is a God. He had to be given authority. So if somebody has to give you something, you do not possess it inherently. Right? This text seems to imply that Jesus had to have this given to him.
Is that working?
Hello?
It's working.
Everybody get better now?
Yeah.
Okay. Yes.
Yeah.
Doing so well with the technology today. If a person dies and immediately goes one place or the other, that doesn't seem to be what this text says, and it's not what Daniel's text says at all. They sleep in the dust of the earth and awake. Sleep is not death. Sleep is unconsciousness, but it is not death. And so here you also have, they're not in heaven, or they're not burning in the lake of torment. They're in their graves, and those who have done well to the resurrection of life, and those who have done evil to the resurrection of judgment. Some of my fundamentalist friends say, doesn't matter what you do, it just matters what you believe. Now, so, here is who did well, resurrection of life. Those who didn't do well. It's about what you did, not what you believe, here. In Matthew's Gospels, we saw before, the sin of omission is what condemns. I was hungry and you didn't give me anything to eat, and I was thirsty and you didn't give me anything to drink. It's the sins of omission which condemn. And the righteous are the ones, I was hungry and you fed me, and I was thirsty and you gave me to drink. So it's not always in Jesus's description what your beliefs are, and often not much about what your beliefs are, but mostly what you do and don't do. And so the question then comes, if they're already with Jesus doing well, why do they have to hear his voice and come forth from their graves? Now, mainstream Christianity, of which this denomination is one, has an answer for this, which requires a little intellectual acrobatics. And here's the intellectual acrobatics that is used. When you die, if you're a believer in Jesus or in good standing with God, your spirit goes to be with him and you're doing just great. And at the resurrection, you get a resurrection body, which gives you the ability to have greater mobility, appear in different manners, not being subject to the physical constraints of the material world. But if you didn't have that resurrection body, you're still with Jesus, right? Immediately upon death. So that is the way it is done in mainstream Christianity. The problem with that, if you examine it more carefully, you don't really need a resurrection to do well. Do you? Die, you know, would be with Jesus, you don't really need the resurrection. You just don't get the added benefit of the resurrection body. Hold that thought as we go through this, because it will come up again when we talk about the resurrection in a few weeks from now. Some of my Jewish friends tell me, there's no life after death in Judaism. That's strictly a Christian concept. And it is true that Judaism in general doesn't have much emphasis upon it, but it's not true that the Hebrew Scriptures don't talk about it. Once you get out of the Torah itself. So here's a very interesting question. This is one of the great questions that all religions pose. If a man dies, shall he live again? In fact, over at Ali, we have courses. That's the name of the course. If a man die, shall he live again? He asks, all the days of my appointed time will I wait until my change comes. What does that mean? Paul in 1 Corinthians 15, talking of the resurrection, says we shall be changed in the twinkling of an eye. When he talks about the resurrection, we shall be changed. And of course, then Job later answered his own question, I know that my Redeemer liveth, he shall stand upon the earth the latter day, and after my skin worms destroy my body, yet in my flesh shall I see God. So Job definitely expects a resurrection to life. This is a very important psalm, and particularly in Christian understanding of it. If you're Jewish, you don't understand it the Christian way, but if you're Christians, you believe that this is the scripture which predicts the resurrection of Jesus. So let me give you this one here. It's also a forerunner of what we're going to talk about later. Psalm 16. You will not leave my soul in hell, neither will you suffer your Holy One to see corruption. You have shown me the path to life, in your presence is fullness of joy, at your right hand your pleasures forevermore. Clearly this talks about a life beyond the grave. By the way, this is a controversial teaching here, a controversial translation. This is King James. Leave my soul in hell. Hell here is the word Hades. Hades is the equivalent of the word in Hebrew, Sheol. And in the King James Version, they're loosely translated hell. But there's another word also translated hell in the King James Version, which comes from Gehenna, which is a place of fire. So Hades is not the same as Gehenna, but they're both translated often as hell in the King James Version. So if you read more modern translations, you'll say, you won't leave my soul in the grave. Hades, Sheol, is the grave. Not a place of torment. Neither will you suffer your... This is also King James English, and you can see how they do it here. Holy One, uppercase. It's not uppercase in any of the original manuscripts or ancient manuscripts. But here, in order to mesh with how it will be later quoted in the New Testament, we go uppercase. Holy One to see corruption. And the book of Acts, this will later be quoted to say, see, David didn't expect his soul to remain in the grave, but the Holy One, meaning Jesus, did not see corruption. David's body saw corruption, but bodies decay when they die. But Jesus, the Holy One's body, did not see corruption because it was raised from the dead. And this is actually one of the principal texts that's used within the New Testament to say that the Hebrew Scriptures predict the resurrection of Jesus. Everybody, any questions about this? Is this a little complicated? No? No? Good. When my Jewish friends tell me that we don't have much talking about life after death, at virtually every Jewish funeral you go to, they will read the 23rd Psalm. 23rd Psalm, surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. And so I will ask them, if you expect to dwell in the house of the Lord forever, how is it you don't believe that there's anything after this life? Because that you say it virtually at every funeral. And it's the most famous of all of the Psalms, the 23rd Psalm. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. Excuse me. And here is the last verse of the book of Ecclesiastes, which is a very dark book, most of it. Vanity of vanity, says the preacher. But in the end, you have a text which vindicates the righteousness of God and does speak of the resurrection of the dead in a roundabout way. God shall bring every work into judgment, every secret thing, whether it be good or evil. And so one of the large questions that's asked, if God is in fact just, how is it that he allows the righteous to be destroyed and evil to prosper? How is that? You can look at the world and you can see that without much difficulty. The righteous are destroyed and the evil prosper, and apparently they can die without any real punishment in this world. But not if that's so. Every work into judgment, every secret thing, whether it be good or evil. There's a wonderful African-American spiritual taken from this verse. I went to the rock to hide my face, and the rock cried out, no hiding place. That every secret thing is eventually revealed. And so, here you vindicate the righteousness of God, who apparently allows evil to prosper in this world, and good to be destroyed. So let me just put some bookends on this very, very brief discussion of this. Not much discussion in the Hebrew Scriptures about this, but Daniel's text is most explicit and is more vague than most New Testament teachings. New Testament teachings regarding this are much more expansive, and the issue of life after death is a principal theme of Christianity. And there are 2 billion Christians in the world, roughly. There are about 14 million Jews. One of the reasons Christianity is as powerful as it is in gathering so many adherents of so many different cultures is it answers the question, if a man dies, shall he live again? It answers it directly and provides a very clear answer regarding the certitude one can have regarding a place in the kingdom of God. It answers that question very directly. Move through this as we go to some other texts, because we don't have enough time to cover it all. I want to talk about a very controversial text, which some scholars believe is called interpolated. Interpolated means not really a statement made by Jesus, but later inserted into the text. And I want to introduce some concepts of verifiable, falsifiable, and something in the middle. There are some things which are verifiable, meaning you can prove through normative means that it's so. There are certain things which can neither be proven true nor false. And there are certain things which are falsifiable, meaning they are provably false. What you're going to read here is something in part which is provably false, and therefore not likely, or maybe not possible, that Jesus would have uttered it. So let's have a look at it. And there are many scholars who think that this is not something that Jesus would have said. This is Jesus in Matthew 23, where he's talking about woes upon the Pharisees, and this is just one of them. The Pharisees now are teachers of the law. They believe in the resurrection of the dead, and they debate with Jesus what the meaning of the law is throughout his ministry. Jesus actually makes a very powerful accusation against them. Does anybody here have a legal background? As a lawyer, you will note this well in the legal background. Jesus will often say, and this is not specifically this text here, that what the Pharisees do with the law in terms of the regulations is ultra vires. Ultra vires. What do I mean by that? Every regulation or executive order that is promulgated has to have, in our society, has to have a legal basis from which it is authorized. So, if I wish to promulgate an executive order, I want to put out a regulation, I have to say that the law authorizes me to do that. Ultra vires means regulations which have no legal basis to them and are simply made up out of whole cloth. What Jesus will say to the Pharisees, which is a very inflammatory thing, is that you have made regulations that are ultra vires, that have no basis in anything in the law. People say, well, Jesus violated the law. Jesus never finds enough time and place where you can find any place where Jesus violates the law, ever. What he accuses the Pharisees of doing is promulgating regulations that are in fact ultra vires, that have no basis in law, something that they made up on their own in order to have control over the people. That is a very powerful accusation, and one of the reasons he wasn't very popular with most of them. Wasn't popular with Sadducees or any of the movements for different reasons as he goes through it. But here, going back to this text, you serpent, your generation of virus, how can you escape the damnation of, this is Gehenna hell. This is not Hades. Hades, everybody goes to the grave. Not everybody goes to the fire. This is Gehenna hell. I send you prophets. Now here, Jesus declares his divinity. I've heard some scholars say Jesus doesn't declare his divinity ever, except in the Gospel of John. But that is really not so. Jesus declares his divinity by appropriating to himself powers which are reserved to God. And so by saying, I send you prophets, the only one who sends a prophet is God. And so by saying that, here he proclaims his divinity. And here's the place where you have something that is a difficult text and probably not something you could have found Jesus saying. Some of them you kill and crucify. The Jews crucified prophets. Jews did never crucify anybody. That is not a Jewish form of execution. And to assert that Jews crucify prophets is demonstrably false. He also here will say that the synagogue is used as a place of torture. Scourge them in your synagogues. So, if you want to, as I think as Reverend said last week, they're talking about replacement theology. The Jews aren't the chosen people anymore because they're now replaced by the church. This is a text that's appealed to by people who are anti-Semites. Okay, see, the synagogue is a place of torture, and Jews ran crucifixions for the prophets. Jews crucified prophets is falsified. And so, read with care. This is why I'm not a fundamentalist. Mm-hmm. I said, please justify this text. I don't. I don't justify it. I will set it forth as an interpolation. That's a very inflammatory basis for anti-Semitism taken as an authentic statement of Jesus. Here are the textual challenges. Just briefly get into some of the textual challenges we have when we look at these texts. First of all, there are no texts in the New Testament or elsewhere that are written by Jesus or claim to be written by Jesus. None. Oh, it would be nice if we had his own writings to review, but we do not. There are no texts written by the opponents of Jesus. So if you'd like to see a text written by contemporary opponents, like Pharisees or the Sadducees, don't exist. And so you don't even get the textual review of the opposing positions. The New Testament texts are written for didactic purposes and not as disinterested historians. They're written so that you should believe in Jesus. And they're not written as a historian would write, you know, with a disinterested person's purpose, meaning I don't have a disinterested, meaning I don't have a dog in the fight. I'm just trying to set the stage here. They're written many years after Jesus. The authorship is uncertain. We say they're written by Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, but nowhere in the text themselves do they claim to be written by Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. If you read the text yourself, you will never find one that says, I, Matthew, take pen in hand and write this. John's gospel claims to be written by the disciple whom Jesus loved. We assume that that is John, but it doesn't explicitly say that. Jesus' disciples were uneducated, and in fact, they were illiterate, most of them. I say that illiterate because not the book I say so. The book of Acts declares them to be illiterate. And so then the question comes, if they're illiterate, how is it that you take pen in hand and are able to compose these very sophisticated compositions? They do present conflicting accounts that are often, if not impossible, to reconcile, which we will see when we talk about the resurrection. Paul's writings are the earliest writings that actually make their way into the New Testament. And Paul was not an original disciple of Jesus. Claims to have known him only through a vision. This becomes a more difficult part. Some New Testament scholars say that some of the texts are forgeries, meaning they have Paul's signature on them, but Paul didn't write them, and others as well. All of this combines to make historical Jesus difficult to reconstruct. I did a lot of controversial stuff, and normally I do a lot more discussion of that when we have more time. So given how much stuff I threw at you, does anybody have any questions regarding? Explain it well. Yes, sir.
It would be unheard of to think that through God that the disciples became educated in order to write it down.
Excellent point. If you hear our colleagues, is it possible that through God's grace, the disciples were able to write this down. Absolutely so. Because if you take a look at the history of the Bible in general, not just these texts, God often takes people of the lowest esteem, people who don't want the job, and gives them the job. And if Jesus were to have gone to Rabbi Gamaliel, the teacher of St. Paul, and said, give me the top 12 students from your seminary, he would maybe say, well, you have these brilliant people writing. But he took the people from the lowest echelons of society, and they became great leaders. Just like Jeremiah. God goes to Jeremiah as a little kid and says, can't be a prophet, I'm just a little kid. And God tells Jeremiah, before I formed you in your mother's womb, I knew you and called you to be a prophet. I'll put my words in your mouth and you'll speak them. And the imprimatur of divine inspiration is that a person who otherwise should not be able to do what they do can. And so this is not the first time you find people who don't have any education doing great things. And so your point is very well taken, that people will say, well, they don't have the education to write this. And yes, Reverend, yes, ma'am.
I would just say, too, that even if it is true that some were clearly Paul's writings and some somebody's disciples, but it wasn't unusual, when you call it a forgery, they didn't think that made it inauthentic. They would often take a famous person and put the name on the letter to lend an authority, and then there still can be deep truth in the letter. You see what I'm saying?
I just see that.
No, but I mean, I think that to me it doesn't matter. I mean, Paul did write certain ones and then not others, but they're still included in Scripture because they contain deep truths about, you know, inspiration from God.
Did everybody hear Reverend's point?
But that was common practice in the ancient world, too.
I will respectfully, for our great reverend, disagree with you. let me give you briefly my disagreement on it. Forgery is fraud. And it's difficult to believe that God imparts divine inspiration by means of fraud. If you take a look at some of the text there, in the Pauline corpus, that are some scholars call forgeries, but not others. They're not unanimous that they're everybody considered not by Paul. There are certain personal things that you wouldn't find. Somebody saying, oh, I'll sign his name to it because I'm his disciple. When you start getting into personal references about, I went here and I did that, and I have fought the good fight, I have finished the race, and I have kept the faith. These are personal references which give people the impression that they are deeply personal reflections and not simply a didactic treatise written by a follower. And so a case can be made that all of the writings, all 13 of his letters, are authentically his. The problem with some of those is that they set forth teachings that even the church doesn't accept. Any church doesn't accept. Such as the path for a woman to be saved is through childbearing. Not true. The path for a woman to be saved is the same way as everybody is saved. A woman is saved through childbearing. That is a statement we find in one of Paul's letters, which is manifestly not true. And if you would say, oh, well, that means she's not going to die in childbirth, that's also manifestly untrue, because Christian women die in childbirth the same way that anybody else dies in childbirth. And if you say, it's their path to eternal salvation, that's taught by no church in any place. So there are statements set forth in these disputed letters which are not part of Christian doctrine of any church. And so therefore, the claim them not to really be by Paul's hand, you have a way of escaping that.
But the ones that are authentic by Paul also contain things that I don't agree with. I don't think that Paul is God, but I do think that God can inspire people who are flawed. That's all I'm saying.
visited colloquially, which we could do a lot of. There are also interpolated passages in the authentic letters of Paul, such as the one which tells women that they have to be silent and never say anything in church, and have any questions they can ask their husbands when they get at home. If we believed that, we wouldn't have our beloved Reverend Leslie, right?
No, 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 no.
We wouldn't have her here if we believed that.
That but, makes perfect sense, actually. But in defense of Holy Scripture, David didn't write all the Psalms either.
But they don't all claim to be written by David. Here's the difference. You only have something that is a forgery when it is a false authorial claim. When somebody writes a thing, I so-and-so write this, and it is a false claim. David, none of the old Psalms claim to have David's signature on, so I wouldn't put them in that category. But I'm very glad that I consider interpolated the business that women are not supposed to say in the church to ask their husbands if they have any questions at home, because that way we get to have our beloved Reverend Leslie here. Interesting policy. I have a little time. Can we go to 10? Go to 10, great. The widow's offering. Jesus is not always just speaking the difficulty to his opponents. He's sometimes giving didactic lessons to his own disciples. This is a great one for all of us. It's not how much you give that counts. It's how much of what you have that counts. So the widow here, we know this one well, casts in everything she has, even though it's just a penny. And others cast in lots, but it's a small fraction of what they have. And so how often do we see people who are declared great philanthropists who actually build monuments to themselves, they put their names on buildings, and they put their names on scholarship funds, they build monuments to themselves that are called great philanthropists, but they give a small fraction of what they have to give. They don't take up Jesus' line. Sell what you have, give to the poor, and follow me. But here, the widow who walks through life with anonymity, nobody knowing who she is, appearing who she is, gives her last cent. And Jesus says, this is valued greatly by God, more than the person who throws in a lot, but who could have given more. It's a matter of what could you give. This moves us to a new segment I'm going to do, but I'm going to just have a little time to introduce it, because next week we want to go to the Last Supper. So there's not enough time here to cover all the material, so I'm really racing through a lot of this. We have two more sessions after this, or three? I think we only have two after this, no? Two. So we're going to want to do the Last Supper, we're going to want to do the trial and crucifixion, and then we'll do the resurrection during the Easter teachings. But let's talk a little bit about the Olivet Discourse. Olivet Discourse is found in three places, and only in the Synoptics and not in John's Gospel account. It's found in Mark 13, Matthew 24, and Luke 21. There are great similarities and some differences. And this is why we always like to do what we call horizontal reading. Take all of the discourses in all of those three Gospels, put them next to each other and see where they agree and see where there are differences. And this is one of the bases for apocalypticism within Christianity. Our church is not focused that much on apocalypticism, but more fundamentalist expressions of Christianity are. Apocalypticism here means end time. Actually, it means technically revealing. So when you say the apocalypse of John, apocalypse means revelation. It means revealing. But it's also come to mean end times. Here is the big ticket question that's asked. He sat upon the Mount of Olives against the temple. That's why they call it the Olivet Discourse. Mm. Peter, James, and John and Andrew asked him privately, tell us when these things shall be, and what shall be the sign that all things shall be fulfilled. tell us about the end of the world, and when it will happen, how it will happen, and what are the signs we can look for. People have then gone to Jesus' statements here, and there's a vast literature about the end of the world on this. Have any of you ever seen the book Left Behind? It's about the rapture, the church is taken out, and all the sinners are left behind to deal with the wrath of God. Apocalyptic Christianity. So let's see some of the things that are said there. I'm only having a few selected portions of it. Many shall come in my name, saying, I am Christ, and shall deceive many. This can be read in a couple of different ways. This first sentence. Many shall come in my name, saying, I am Christ, and shall deceive many. And so some have said, what is Jesus saying here at the end of the time? Will show that there'll be lots of false Christs coming around, people claiming that they're Christ. But actually, if you read it carefully, it says, many shall come in my name, saying that I, Jesus, am Christ, and shall deceive many. And so you'll have lots of people who are deceivers claiming Jesus is Christ and shall be deceivers. It can be read two ways, depending on how you like to do it. Remember, there's no punctuation in the originals. All punctuation is added. All punctuation is added. And so where you put punctuation matters a great deal. Just as an aside from this, we mentioned about going to heaven immediately or sleeping in the dust of the earth. Going off a little bit, but talk a little bit about the issue of punctuation. This may be the last thing I have time to do, and we'll get to this in more detail next week, because I only have 2 minutes left. Our Seventh-day Adventist brothers believe that there's no immediate going off to heaven when you die. They believe you sleep in the dust of the earth, and at the end is the resurrection, you come forward in resurrection. And people have asked them, well, how do you explain Jesus' promise to the thief on the cross? Today you will be with me in paradise. How do you explain it? They have a really interesting explanation for it, and here it goes. They'll say to you that there is no punctuation in the original text. And there's not. All punctuation is added. So it depends upon where you choose the place to come. So let's see how it's placed normally. Truly I say unto you, come. Today you will be with me in paradise. That says you're going today. But let's say I move the comma over. Truly I say unto you today, comma, you will be with me in paradise. That doesn't mean you're going today. It means I'm making a promise today. And everything changes based upon the comma, and there is no punctuation in the early manuscripts. So by moving the comma, you change the theology. Are you following all that?
Yeah.
I'm not going to. Thanks for coming. See you next week.